Comrades, on the 14th of July, 1989, a contingent of French soldiers suitably dressed in 18th century costumes will storm a building made of plastic and canvas suitably erected in the Place de la Bastille in Paris, because, of course, it is the 200th anniversary. And they are doing it for their own purposes, of course. Nevertheless, 1789 was a real turning point in world history. Its impact at the time was enormous. In the interest of brevity, I will use only the best known and most hackneyed of quotations. You know, the young Wordsworth, he became a reactionary later, wrote, "Joy was it in this dawn to be alive, but to be young was very heaven," and so on. That was fairly typical of the reaction of that quite small minority of Europeans at the time who had any notion of political consciousness. So what was it all about? And we should ask ourselves the question, which many historians have done, often for reactionary purposes, but never mind, why was there a revolution in France in 1789? And to ask the question is actually of interest, not only in connection with the French Revolution, but with revolutions in general. Okay? To answer it, we have to look at the old regime. What was it, in essence? What are the important features of it? How was it distinguished from most of the other European regimes of the time, which were of the same fundamental type? It was distinguished from them by the following features, in some cases only by degree. First of all, it was a highly centralized regime. Now, that might appear to be a contradiction. People talk about feudalism, feudal regime, as we shall see. The French revolutionaries themselves talk about the abolition of feudalism. In many respects, the regime was the very opposite of feudal anarchy. Successive French kings or their ministers, from the 15th century onwards, really the 11th, 15th century turning point, had sought to curb and bridle the power of the then genuinely feudal aristocracy to centralize the regime. And they have done so over a period of centuries, and in the course of many struggles, not by a radical transformation, which of course they were incapable of achieving, they themselves were at the top of the feudal regime, but by superimposing on humanity, if you like, an elaborate, bureaucratic, hierarchical structure. And this structure had a number of features. The two most important ones are: one, it was very expensive. Two, it was very inefficient. A vast complexity of conflicting and overlapping jurisdictions and so on and so forth. That's the first thing. The second thing was, of course, that the whole thing nevertheless rested on layers of privilege of an essentially feudal sort. Now, this we can deal with briefly. Example. Not very important, but rather illuminating. A woman's place was, of course, determined in society at the time by the position of her husband. The husband of a noble, of whatever kind, was entitled to be called madame. And the wife, I mean, the wife of a respectable and affluent bourgeois was entitled to be called not madame, but mademoiselle. Right? The meaning of the words have changed. The wife of an ordinary woman was addressed without any prefix whatsoever. A trivial, utterly trivial point, but actually illustrative of the whole character of the regime. The important privileges of the upper classes were, of course, related to money, to taxation. The taxation question, as we'll see, was very, very important. In practice, not strictly in law, as a matter of fact, by 1789, but in practice, the upper classes, in particular the aristocracy, paid little or no tax. The whole tax burden was shifted on the lower classes. Not primarily, by the way, on the bourgeoisie, but primarily on the peasantry. Which brings me to the question, briefly, of orders and classes. You see, In the political theory of the old regime, the government, the regime, is in a certain sense representative. That was the theory. What does it represent? It represents what were called orders. Now, orders are not quite the same thing as classes. There were three of them. The first order consisted of clerical order. It consisted of all those who, in one way or another, were priests or nuns or what have you, religious of the Roman Catholic Church, the state church. Far from being a class. At the top of that order, there were princes of the church with enormous lands, resources, and so on. At the bottom of that order, and far, far more numerous, were village cures, many of whom were as poor as most peasants. Nevertheless, they constituted an order. They were part of the structure of society. The second was the nobles, the aristocracy. Again, although we tend to use the term as though it corresponded to a class, it did not really. Just as with the clerical order, on the one hand, you have people like the Duke of Orleans and so on with enormous properties all over the country and so on and so forth. Fabulously wealthy, although often in debt incidentally, but fabulously wealthy. On the other hand, you have people whose place in society depended on the fact that they could show that they were descended on both sides for X generations from people who were nobles. Surely almost everyone must have seen one of the film versions of The Three Musketeers. Well, I mean, that's the century before, but the same thing applies. Now, D'Artagnan, and still more, Athos, Porthos, and Aramis were all nobles, right? As you know, if you've read the book, most of the time they had got two sous to rub together and were wondering how they could get some wine for nothing. This back impoverished, the Scots called the equivalent class hedge knights in the 15th and 16th century, people who were distinguished by birth, but their birth no longer corresponded to a real position in society. Now this is very, very important, you see, a dislocation, a basic dislocation between the official status hierarchy and the privileges which go with it, and the reality of wealth and power, which brings us to the third estate. Now, the third estate is a vast conglomerate, far from being a class. A conglomerate of all sorts of things. The important members of the third estate were bourgeoisie, partly commercial, and even to some extent an industrial bourgeoisie, some of whose members were very wealthy. Plus, certain professions, lawyers in particular, the revolution, while the early part of the revolution was dominated by lawyers, and people who held one sort or another of official position in this vast, complicated, bureaucratic structure. Beneath them are the masses. Four-fifths of the population, at least, were peasants or members of peasants' families. They too, technically, are part of the third estate, of course. And then, in the towns, artisans, wage earners, etc. This great conglomerate called the third estate. Okay, now why have I spent so much time on that? Because, you see, to understand the course of events, you've got to see the real reason there's a revolution in this period and not a process of progressive adjustment is that there's a fundamental disconnection between the political structure, the privileges that go with it and so on, and the real wealth, power, occupation and so on in the country. Okay, now then, let's look briefly at the situation of the four-fifths, or thereabouts. The whole weight of the state machine, the whole burden of taxation, for practical purposes, rested on these people who cultivated the land. Estimates vary, and probably varied at different times and certainly from place to place, but between two-thirds and four-fifths of what was produced by the peasant cultivator, and there weren't any other kind with any significance, were taken in feudal dues, in tithes, which meant a 12th, by the way, in France, and not a 10th. I don't understand why, but nonetheless. Right, which went to the church, introduced the aristocracy, and to put all in taxes to the state, by far the heaviest of the three burdens. There's a lovely picture, there's something to be said, you know, for the old-fashioned projector slide lecture, because I would love to show this. It's a contemporary one. I think it's from about 1787 or so. And it's, we would call it a cartoon. And it shows you, it tells the whole story, it shows you the peasant in his smock, careworn, and with his back bent. And sat on top of him at the front, on his neck, there's this noble with his great plumed hat and his sword, and so on. The sword is a badge of rank, you see, the right to wear the sword strictly confined to the aristocracy. And behind him, this lady with, you know, those enormous hairdos they had at the time. God knows how they kept them up without hairspray, but anyway, and very elaborate dresses and so on. And here is this poor fellow trying to, he's got a hoe in his hand, cultivate the soil under the burden of these two vast, fat people. And then there's his wife on the other side, and they show the other privileged lord there. And on her shoulders, she too, actually I think she's sewing something or trying to sew something, bent and worn and so on. On her shoulders is a big fat bishop, complete and utter bishop that looks like. And behind him, what I presume is an abbess or something, a lady in clerical dress. And they are both bigger than she is. Now, that essentially is the reality, but wait a minute. That does not explain why there was a revolution. After all, the state of the peasantry in France was bad, but by far, the state of the peasantry in large parts of Eastern Europe was considerably worse. Considerably worse. Not only legally, but in economic terms. A brief word about the legal status of the peasantry. The great majority of them were legally free. We'll come to the question of the abolition of feudalism in a moment or two. The great majority were legally free. About a third of them were freeholders. That is to say, they actually owned the land that they worked. But they still had to pay feudal dues. Right? Although they were formerly owners, the equivalent of the English copyholders, they actually had a legal title to the land. They were still burdened with feudal dues as well as with tithe and taxation. Then, a much larger group, the precise size of which is disputable, is argued about, were in effect what we would call sharecroppers. Certainly the majority were sharecroppers. That is to say, they had no legal title to the land on which they worked. That belonged either to a noble or to the church, etc., etc. But they had, by custom, a right, and the right to pass it on to their children in return for a portion of the crop. The burden on them was even greater. And finally, because some people, particularly business historians, would have you forget this, as late as July 1789, there were still about 1 million peasants in France, mostly in the northeast, who were still legally serfs, tied to the soil, unable to leave it, except by paying a fine and with the permission of the proprietor, etc., etc. Still having to pay dues on the marriage of a daughter, etc., 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 because you see, that means she's going out in the place instead of working here. I mean, this is their general position. It does not explain, however, does not explain, I repeat, why there's a revolution. The majority of the peasants in the Austrian Empire, except its Belgian portion, were serfs, legally serfs, and so on. Russia, the population was becoming more and more insert. Now then, what happens then? Why the crisis? We have to look at this crisis, actually goes back earlier in the 18th century, but look at it in terms of the 2 years, 1787 to 1789. You look at the French economy. Perhaps you may have got the impression from what I've just said, my God, this is a backward place. Come on, we're talking about 18th century standards. As a matter of fact, by 18th century standards, France was economically relatively advanced. French commerce was extensive. Bordeaux was as big a port, or bigger, it depends, I suppose, it's people in Bordeaux who say that, was on any calculations than London, which was at that time by far the biggest city in Europe. Nantes was a much more important commercial centre than either Bristol or Liverpool. There was a rich bourgeoisie that was getting richer out of foreign trade, and a number of other things, tax farming and so on and so forth. There was a bourgeoisie that was becoming more prosperous and bigger. Second, there was the aristocracy, the privileged layers, were, on the whole, and again we have to be very careful when we talk about the aristocracy, because it's such a variegated collection, typically the situation of all but the court aristocrats, the people at the top, the people who get the patronage, was economically deteriorating, at least from the 1730s onwards. The number of D'Artagnans, in other words, was increasing, and the number of dukes of all their own work was shrinking. Obviously, there can only be one title, but the number of magnates was shrinking. The number of hedge knights was increasing. Consequently, from about 1750 onwards, although you can trace it earlier, there occurred what was called the feudal reaction. Lefebvre, great French left-wing historian of the previous generation, called it the aristocratic revolution. What it amounted to was this. Earlier kings of France had, I say earlier, I mean from the 15th century onwards, sought to weaken the power of the great nobles by a number of devices, one of which was by giving away titles to whoever they fancied doing, which is important royal privilege. Are you a noble? If I say so, yes. If I say not, no. But secondly, of course, by employing in the bureaucracy people of decidedly, in the upper echelons, plebeian origin. Now, precisely because of the combination of the growth, wealth of the bourgeoisie on the one hand, the growing economy, and on the other hand, the impoverishment of the mass of large part of the nobility, from about the middle of the century, and increasingly successfully, the aristocracy claimed the right to monopolize positions of all kinds. The most notorious case is, of course, the church. In 1789, there was not a single bishop in France, and there are a hell of a lot of bishops, 120, I think, not a single one who was not a noble descended from nobles on both sides for three generations. And of course, many of some of these bishoprics were small and poor. You know, you remember the one in Les Misérables. He was a constitutional bishop, but he'd taken over an old small see, or he'd been given it. Some of them were fabulously wealthy, fabulously wealthy. Many of them, of course, did not pursue any clerical function. No, some no, anyway. A good many of them spent virtually all their time at court intriguing, and intriguing is not simply a matter of pleasure, if you like gallop or some sort. It's unconscious, a question of money, resources, promotion, etc., etc. Nevertheless, increasingly monopolized. Hence, there was a division within the clerical order. The events of 1789 were to show real class hatred between large numbers of poor priests below and the princes of the church at the top. That's of great political importance. The feudal reaction also meant that whereas, until the middle of the century, it had been relatively easy for a successful bourgeois to acquire a patent of nobility. After all, it's a royal prerogative. And then, second generation anyway, you're indistinguishable from the rest. Now it was becoming increasingly difficult. Indeed, the power of the monarchy, vis-à-vis the aristocracy, and this is what Lefebvre meant when he talked about an aristocratic revolution, was diminishing. The feudal reaction, therefore, fueled, pushed, if you like, by the economic situation of much of the aristocracy, used a big tension, a big conflict in the political superstructure. And finally, the whole question of the financial crisis and the general decrepitude of the regime. Why a financial crisis? France was, by 18th century standards, a wealthy, a prosperous country. The mass of the people were very poor, so the mass of the English, the Scots and so on. It was, by European standards, a prosperous country. With any rational or half-rational system of taxation, it would not have been difficult to support the extravagances of the court, the cost of war, major factor. The final financial crisis came as a result of a French intervention in favor of the American Revolution. They were highly successful, actually, and revenge the results of the 7 Years' War. Bam! The state was bankrupt. It was bankrupt, however, not because of shortage of resources, but because the classes that controlled the bulk of the wealth could not be taxed. In passing, I didn't mention this, I should have done. The First Order, the Clerical Order, claimed the right of total exemption from taxation. Now, they knew that was an unrealistic position in truth, but they maintained it in theory, and it was accepted in theory. Instead, they gave what they called a free gift every so often. In other words, when the centre was really desperate and was squeezing hard and so on, they would vote X. They would vote, they would decide what they would pay. And they free gift. This is not a tax, you understand. Who is the sacred order cannot be taxed. The aristocracy, again, in spite of successive attempts to impose new taxes, which would apply to everyone, successfully resisted this. Consequently, the regime was bankrupt. Now then, we come to the events of 79 itself, of 89 itself. You see, growing crisis, succession of ministers. The king, Louis XVI, was a vacillating sort of person, half inclined to reform. He kept calling in people with modern ideas, relatively modern ideas, Swiss bankers, etc. And appointing them, they would come up, solve the crisis. And they would come up with eminently plausible schemes, showing that a quite modest level of taxation would solve the problem over a period if the privileged orders paid taxes. And of course, attempts were made to enforce this. Actually, several royal decrees were made. They all had to be rescinded. And consequently, and this is why it's important to remember the first part about the conflicts in amongst the possessing classes. The monarchy was driven at the end of the day to say to the possessing classes, in effect, all right, you lot sort it out. Now, of course it wasn't quite as good as that. There was an institution called the States General. It had met for the last time in 1614. Quite a long time ago. Where do you know that? It represented the three recognised estates. And it did represent them in the sense that it consisted of, in the case of the nobility, all the great nobles, and then representatives of the lesser nobles, in the case of the church, all the princes of the church, plus elected cures and so on. In the case of the third estate, elected members. It had always done so. Such institutions were common in Europe in the period of high feudalism, partly devised whereby the monarchy extracted money. Okay, the States General was called. Basically, the States General was called as an act of desperation by the monarchy, monarch's advisers, because it could see no way out of the growing financial crisis. Okay, then we have a problem. Between 1614 and 1789, the social structure had changed very substantially. Not as far as the peasantry is concerned, right? But as far as the relative position of the bourgeoisie and the aristocracy. The bourgeoisie, of course, dominating the elections of the third estate. Elections were held. There are some interesting sidelines for these elections, but I haven't time to go into them. And the three estates were duly summoned to Paris. Or rather, their representatives were. Problem. Under the old system, they had always voted by estate. That is to say, each estate has one vote in the decision. So, you have a majority in one estate, that's one vote. Now, there are two estates dominated by the privileged class. And the third estate, representing, as its spokesman said, at least 95% of the useful population, etc., etc., has one vote for their two. Therefore, from the beginning, far from solving the problem, the calling of the States General precipitated a crisis. I haven't time, I don't think. No, I certainly haven't time to go through this crisis in the wealth of detail, which I carefully prepared, I assure you I did prepare. I will simply say this. The break with legality. Which is important. The break with legality occurs on the question of whether or not the States General should meet at one, as one body, which would mean that the non-legally privileged have the great majority, or as three. The third estate voted, actually, not immediately, but actually, we really are the representatives. We invite the other two. The monarchy refused to accept, of course, a meeting altogether. We invite the other two to join us, and two fingers to the royal decree. You know, the famous tennis court oath, refused to disperse, and all the rest of it. And they won. Now, it's interesting, you see, that first breach in legality, that first big shaking of the system, which had occurred well before the Bastille was taken, was important. Because they were able to split the clerical estate. A minority at first, but then an increasing majority of all but the Prince of the Church element in the first estate agreed. Then, precise date, what was the precise date? I'll have to check. Again, before the taking of the Bastille, the augmented third estate decided, passed the resolution saying, we are the National Assembly of the French people. The old estate system was gone. They were joined, incidentally, at this stage, by a small minority, a significant minority of so-called liberal nobles. Just make a remark in passing about them. You know the liberal nobles were? I mean, not their individual names, doesn't mean anything. But of the 30 who came in the first instance, the great majority were very wealthy. They were not the Hedgenites. On the contrary, they were, if you like, the most privileged, but the ones depending least on legal privilege and much more on their wealth and so on and so forth. Hence the National Assembly. Now look, here we have a regime in crisis. It is an absolute monarchy. Theoretically, whatever the king says is law. He has to go through certain formalities. You know, just as a pope can't say, can't make an infallible declaration unless he goes through a certain ritual. First. If he goes through a ritual, then it's true. If he doesn't go through the ritual, it's not valid. Ditto with the French monarchy. The point is, however, it's an absolute monarchy. And here the monarchy is being flatly defined. He refused to accept, in the first instance, that the estates should meet together, and then shuffles and hedges and so on. And yet, at the same time, what is the basis of the National Assembly? Theoretically, and it was to be shown very soon that not in practice, as the king controls the state machine. Hence, from the beginning, at the stage of the bourgeois stage of the revolution, there is a situation in which, in order to maintain their own position, the rather conservative representatives of the third estate, two-thirds of them lawyers, by the way. I don't mean two-thirds practically lawyers, but two-thirds of them have some kind of legal qualification. Many of them very well-heeled, very comfortable gentlemen, as in Daumier's cartoons, although they come later. Nevertheless, from the beginning, in order to secure a real base, they had to appeal to other classes. Now a digression. I said appeal. That's perhaps being too kind. They did. Their more far-sighted representatives saw that, but they were pushed by events. Because so far we have been talking about what's been happening in Paris at the centre. In July and August, there was a massive revolt in the countryside. It was complicated, and we haven't time for complications, so we will look at the broad picture, very handy word that, and its implications. Not all at the same time, but first in one province, then in another. The peasantry, the actual peasants, what they wanted, legal documents, proceeded to storm town halls, chateaux, etc., which are not typical birds at that stage, by the way, unless they only resisted, and made bonfires of the legal documents which said they owed this, they owed that, they owed the other, in terms of dues and so on. There was this massive inchoate movement, which was not, by the way, led, so far as we can tell, from the centre anywhere. There are arguments about this, but the important thing is that while the arguments in Paris were going on as to who is going to sit where and who has a vote and who doesn't have a vote, the countryside was being transformed. And remember, this is 4/5 of the population. The depth of the thing, previously it had been a squabble amongst the privileged classes, because although the Third Estate was not legally privileged, in fact, by any of our criteria, its leaders were highly privileged people. But this vast movement from below was a movement of the very unprivileged. They got rid of at a stroke the payment of feudal dues and the payment of tithes, totally illegally, without a shred of legal justification. They burned the documents, they set up meetings where there was resistance, they overcame the resistance, they killed a few nobles, not very many at that time, or some of the Roman peasants, they roasted spears now. Nevertheless, in general, right, the movement was so overwhelming that resistance to it wasn't really impossible. Meanwhile, the government is paralysed. The government is paralysed because of the inability of the Third Estate to get a real and stable basis in the first instance, or the monarchy to reassert itself. That's a highly unstable position. What was actually happening, therefore, at the centre was this. Around the monarchy, intrigues, concentrate troops in Paris, it is necessary to destroy the assembly. The king must exert his will, etc. He's a wet. We must put some backbone into him. 30,000 regular troops were concentrated in late June, early July, in the Paris region, within marching distance of Paris. The king was not in Paris, by the way. He hadn't been since Louis XIV's time, lived at Versailles, and had a splendid palace and all the rest of it. And preparations made to crush the assembly. Now, it was in this atmosphere of rumour, many of the rumours justified, many of them, of course, fantastic, that a coup, a royalist coup, was impending. That the events that we started with, and by God, it's taken long enough to get back to them, the storming of the Bastille occurred on the 14th of July, and this was not a spontaneous operation, not at all. It was carried out by determined sections of the left, so to say, of the bourgeois leadership in Paris. It's interesting. Because of the industry of French historians, and French Revolution studies are a big industry in France and have been since the 19th century, I mean a big academic industry, we actually know the names of a large number of the people who took part in the storming of the Bastille, and we know the names of all the ones who were dead, right? You know who they were? They were not, typically, the poor. They were, typically, relatively well-to-do people, lawyers, attorneys of one sort or another, one brewer, two or four, come on! Money in brewing! Okay. Several grain merchants, soldiers on leave, and crucially, most important, and this is the only point I'm going to mention this, because it is fundamentally important, what was the decisive, who played the decisive role at the key moment, you know, when the thing is teetering? I don't know if you've seen the picture. Well, you will. It's on the front cover of the advert for Marxism Today. Of the Bastille as it looked in 1789, you know, it's being stopped. It's enormous. Bloody place. These great towers. It looks, if people have seen the Chateau de Vincennes, right? No, you haven't. I was seeing ones too. It was like that. I mean, there's no way in which a crowd of people with a few stolen muskets, etc., can see it. No, no! The defensive gates were blown in by a detachment of the Royal French Artillery of the Guard. Now, all of whose officers, by definition, were aristocrats. In other words, the depth of the movement in the countryside was affecting sections of people who were themselves objectively part of the privileged classes. Now, it is quite true, they did not foresee what was to come. They saw this, the storming of this old prison fortress, a symbol of tyranny and royal authority, as a symbolic act against the conspirators, against the people who would disperse the National Assembly and so on. They saw it as an act of defense, but of course, it was an act of defiance, and from then on, we have a rapidly escalating process. Rapidly at first. Look, let us run through the course of events. Louis is still at Versailles. The intrigues continue. it is increasingly clear that the bulk of the regular army is unreliable, is unusable. The bulk of the officers are probably reliable, but the general calculation is, you can't do it, you can't do it. Hence, intrigues with foreigners, with the princes, German princes along the Rhine. There was not a unified German state at the time. All manner of intrigues, some possibility of success, others fantastic. You know, reactionaries going mad and so on. This something new. The court at Versailles was the centre, the festering nest of counter-revolution. Because by this time, we can say the bourgeois revolution, the strictly bourgeois revolution, is quite well advanced. Hence, the famous October march of women to Versailles. And like practically every other event, I can see I'm only going to get as far as Barney, but no event. Like practically every other event in this period, is encrusted with myth. It is quite true that a group of women, demanding bread, not that in the moment was soon, did march to Versailles. But the important thing that marched to Versailles was the Paris National Guard. Where did that come from? After the storming of the Bastille, a good bourgeois Paris, you know, but, you know, there's a lot of lean and hungry folk around here. We need a force to keep law and order, our law, our order. Now, you can't have the Royal Army still theoretically under the control of the King, and the last thing we want are more troops in Paris. No. Therefore, we must create a force of our own, the National Guard, and they were imitated by the corresponding people in all the major cities. Now, the National Guard, again, was set up without royal sanction, although a half sanction was screwed out of the reluctant King at a later stage. It was essentially the force of the respectable bourgeoisie. It was largely recruited from their sons and apprentices and sons-in-laws and so on and so forth. It was a bourgeois force. Okay? Behind this group of women demonstrating against bread shortages and high prices was the Paris National Guard. Led by a nobleman, by the way, the Marquis de Lafayette, who played a role in the American Revolution, was becoming increasingly alarmed and increasingly conservative as time went on, but again, this is fairly typical of revolutionary movements, finding that his ranks, he's the commander, insist on going, he puts himself at their head. I will lead you, he says, meaning to lead him up the garden path, but in fact, carried by the force, let's say, go to Versailles, and then they make a real break with the path. Louis is brought back as a prisoner to Paris. He's brought back to the old palace of the Louvre, which hadn't been used since the 17th century, which he was never again to be allowed to leave until he went to the guillotine. The king was a prisoner, and consequently, for a time, the forces of feudalists in court's reaction were paralysed. Now we have the real problem, and about this, I must spend a little time. A little time, not too long, I promise you. You see, here we have a central problem, not just for the French Revolution, but for any bourgeois revolution. In that period, certainly, and subsequently. Come on. The law, legality, has been torn up. You think about it. All the things, not all the things they've done, the succession of things I've talked about, are all high treason. Absolutely no question about it. You've no possible defence in a court of the old regime. Not because they twist the evidence, but because of the reality. Yes? The law has been persistently defied, and not only by the bourgeoisie, but remember, by the mass of the peasantry. Therefore, the question of property rights, bourgeois property rights, so it's centrally important. We need a stable regime. They looked to the model, of course, across the channel. The English bourgeois revolution was more than a century in the past. Here we had national compromise, still had a House of Lords and so on, but a thoroughly bourgeois regime. That's what we want. How the hell do we get there? It's a pity we're 120 odd years later. How do we get there? All the subsequent developments, internal and external, until the end of the Terror, have to be seen in this light. And here I depart from chronology to talk about the forces. The forces that emerged. We must not think of parties in the modern sense, you know, with special committees, general secretaries, anything of that sort, membership cards, nothing of the kind. But we can talk about parties in the sense of tendencies, real tendencies. And these tendencies we must go through very briefly. First, the biblical, please off out first, Girondist, better known term, doesn't matter why. What were they? These were typified by the great shipowners of Bordeaux and Nantes and so on. Big bourgeois. I don't mean to say that their troopers, their auditors and so on were all of this kind, not related to the families. But this was a big bourgeois party, basically. And of course, they have been, prior to 1789, very, very hostile to the regime. Now, however, they wanted to inherit what they regarded as their due. And their central notion was, no further. No further. Nothing more must be done. Of course, there will have to be a constitution. Unfortunate, but there will. There will have to be some, an elected assembly. We want that, yes. And we've got to arrange matters so that our people, as a certain lady said, are ensured of a majority, a safe majority, and so on and so forth. But these dangerous tendencies against law and order and so on must be cured. That's one force. The second force was also bourgeois. This is the Jacobins, which I have no illusions whatever about that. The Jacobins represented to some extent, you could say, had an economic basis. Typically, they were not wealthy. But they were bourgeois, all right. They, too, wanted bourgeois law and order. But partly because of economic grievances, and partly because of ideas, they believed that in order to establish a stable bourgeois regime, it is necessary to go further. The English Compromise won't do. Louis must lose his head. Not only must Louis lose his head, but the whole privilege structure and so on must be abolished. Out and out, abolished. So that formally, all citizens are equal. In brackets, before the law. For France in 1789, 1790 by this time, that was an enormous advance. That was the Jacobin tendency. So then there were those people who variously called Saint-Culottes, Granoux, etc., fundamentally representing artisans, some wage earners, some small employers, because the bourgeoisie was not quite so homogeneous, right? The left, a nasty lot. In the view of the dominant Huron faction. And finally, we should not forget there was the feudal reaction. Because what began to happen, particularly in 1790, was that increasingly the centre of reaction was transferred from France to across the Rhine. Large numbers of nobles became émigrés. And of course they became émigrés, not with the notion of, well, I'm going to start a new life in the Duchy of Cleves or something. Not at all. They became émigrés on the basis of trying to organise foreign troops, which they hoped their German friends would provide, to re-establish the old regime. Right. Now then, back to the course of events and very quickly. No, I'm sorry. There must be one further digression. Sorry. It's called bread, riots and revolution. Now, the harvest of 1788 had been bad. Wheat prices rose. The majority of French people, peasants, artisans and so on, lived on bread. They spent most of their income on bread, and much of the rest on wine. Oh, that's no joke. I mean, you know, bread and wine was the staple basis of the peasant diet. Now, consequently, they're very, very, very sensitive to movement in bread prices. Hence, there are always riots. Now here, and this is a very important point, such riots go way back to the Middle Ages. One. Two, such riots were in no sense peculiar to France. Indeed, you know, argued by some historians, the classic country of the riot was 18th century England. Right? No, riots were endemic. Every time, and the process was well understood. You know, rather as managements understand how you try to manage a strike now in conjunction with the trade union leadership. You know, you've got to have one. The process was well understood. What you do about it, you've got to actually screw some bread out somewhere, you've got to punish the ringleaders, you've got to give away bread. You do various things, you see. Normally they could be coped with. But you see, in the period 89 and 90, when bread prices fluctuated, but were typically rising and high, because of the lack of a stable authority, the riot becomes an important component of a revolution. And hence we slide to the phase, really, of the, what we can call the popular revolution. You see, every step taken by, first of all, the Legislative Assembly, then the Constituent Assembly, Legislative Assembly, National Convention, they kept changing the labels, and they did have some elections, we haven't time to go into all that. Every step taken is correlated very, very closely with movements from below. The March for the Women on Versailles, these women did not start out, contrary to myths, with notions about the king or the king Paris and father his people or anything like that. They started out very simply saying the price of bread is too high, we want bread, right? But that became a political thing in a serious sense because it fused with other forces. And so onwards now.